6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning's Edition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. Did I miss one? Where am I? What's going on? It's Monday morning. Mark Riley still away, still at Disney World with his family. You know, we got some email, Kalo. Got some email that said, what do you keep giving Disney World free plugs for? It's like, look, the guy's going to Disney World. What are you supposed to see? Mark Riley is in on some undisclosed location with his family having fun with large puppets. What are we supposed to say?
It's the truth.
I mean, that's all, you know, and people are like, hey, come on, dude, you're working for the mouse. No, we're just saying where Riley is. I mean, take it easy, for God's sake. Hey, thank you, everybody who came down on Friday to the Strand Bookstore. What a party that was. That was unbelievable. We had people crawling out of the woodwork, crawling out of the bookshelves. Some guy, what was his name? Al P.W., who brought me the picture? Some guy brought me this picture. I got to go get it on the break. I said I'd hang it up. I said, now that we got all the Franken stuff off the walls in here, because he's moved to a more comfortable television studio, I'm going to put the Marc Maron picture right up here, and, you know, it'll happen. Sam and Janine will deface it somehow or leave notes on it.
Wait, it's a picture of Marc Maron?
It's a picture of my head from the last live performance that he took and made it look kind of cool. It's me smiling. I mean, you know, I'm not a big fan of me in pictures, but this picture's not bad. Is that okay? I've had a self-esteem moment. It's a high self-esteem moment. So I've just declared it High Self-Esteem Monday. Would that be all right? Today's High Self-Esteem Monday.
Yay.
Can you sound a little more excited? I feel good about myself. I was in the hallway here, and we broadcast out of WBLS here in New York, and Steve Harvey is down the hall. I guess he's the new morning guy over there on BLS for New York City.
They have another new morning show?
Yeah.
Another new black radio morning show?
Yeah, they got a new guy over there. But Steve Harvey's done it before, and I'm listening. They got it piping into the lounge. He's like, good morning! It's Monday! I'm in the Apple! Good morning, Queens! Staten Island! And I'm like, oh my God, am I starting my show off wrong? You know what I mean? The guy was like, hey, when I get up, I like to say a little prayer. So why don't we all say a little prayer and be grateful? You know, and he was just going off, and I'm like, hey, I felt uplifted coming in here. But now let's plunge into Dick Cheney. All right, here we go. You know what I mean? All right, you guys.
That's awesome. What? How was your weekend, by the way?
The weekend was very good. My wife came into town Saturday. I went to see Lords of Dogtown.
How was that? I hear that's great.
I thought it was pretty good, but right away, Brendan P. W. McDonald said, did you see the documentary? The documentary called Dogtown and Z-Boy?
Yeah.
I said, no, I didn't. He goes, well, people saw the documentary, so the movie sucks.
Oh.
So then I had to say, well, I'm not kind of, well, I, all right, I guess you're right. I guess it did suck, and I'm an ass. I'm sorry.
How great do those guys look without shirts, by the way?
Well, what are you talking about?
You know, the
I used to love the fat guy.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like Heath Ledger, by the way, does
yeah.
a great...
drunk guy. Oh, you
yeah.
saw it? You saw it?
No, I just saw the preview.
What are you talking about,
which is great. Give us our trophy!
So
he just acts like a maniac.
You're basing it all on the preview?
Oh, yeah, it's a great preview.
Hmm. I thought the movie was very good. I assume that the documentary is goes a little more into their life. And, you know, I just saw it outside of the structure of a teen movie where, you know, you could definitely see the plot points. All the kids did a great job. Heath Ledger did a great job. And that woman who directed it, whose name eludes me, who did Catherine Hardwicke, who did 13, has a real good sense of, you know, adolescent energy. The whole thing is just like, ah! You know, just people running around, just all that weird kind of 14, 15-year-old energy. Let's see, I will get into some news here because I know that's what we're here to do, and it's Monday morning. But I also will say another thing about the Lords of Dogtown is if you lived in I was like 13 or 14 when that stuff was going on, and I of course wasn't skating pools because I'm a wuss. My brother had a board, and he tried to do it, and he hurt himself a little bit, but not too badly. But I do remember it on the periphery of my consciousness. I remember that happening. So for me, going to see that movie and seeing the haircuts, the soundtrack was great.
What was it?
Well, you know, that old Joe Walsh songs and old sort of like, they had all the music from the mid-70s that I grew up with, and it was very exciting to hear it for some reason. I got it, you know. Of course, my wife, who's younger than me, was like, I don't know, what is this, a music video? I mean, yeah, like, for who? A music video? Who would this be a music? You know how that criticism is? This is a music video. They're just trying to sell music. I'm like, right, you know, Joe Walsh is, you know, turned to stone, need to sell a few more copies. I mean, yeah, you're right. But anyways, she,
little generation got there, huh?
That always happens around music. So all you people that thought that Howard Dean should be stifled. All you Democrats out there that thought that, hey, he doesn't speak for us, you know, primarily, you know, John Edwards, who were some of the other ones that spoke out? Oh, you know, Joe Biden, Bill Richardson from New Mexico were all saying, all freaked out, and they wanted to distance themselves from Howard Dean, saying that the Republican Party was pretty much a Christian party, was the quote, pretty much a white Christian party. Well, first of all, I would like to say that I've crunched some numbers with the help of some stories I've read. 99% of Republicans in the state legislators in all 50 states and in Congress in Washington, D.C. are white. Even in states and districts with large minority populations, the Republican representatives for those places are almost uniformly white Christians. Of 3,643 Republicans serving in state legislatures across the country, only 44 of them are minorities. That's amounting to about 1.2%. Texas, with a minority population of 47%, has 106 Republicans in the state legislature. There are exactly zero African Americans and exactly zero Hispanics serving in that body as Republicans. In Washington, D.C., 274 of the 535 elected senators and representatives are Republican. Exactly five are minorities. So, not only was Howard Dean right, but all of you people that allowed there to be a schism in our party, the Democratic Party, and let this happen, that we start eating our own. You open the door for people like Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney, who is going to be on Fox News tonight, on Hannity and Combs. You allow him, you give him an opportunity, you show him our vulnerabilities, and he gets to make comments because he sees that we're eating our own here. Okay, he called Howard Dean over the top. He said, quote, not the kind of individual you want to have representing your political party, end quote. He said, quote, I've never been able to understand his appeal. Maybe his mother loved him. I've never met anybody who does. He's never won anything as best I can tell, end quote. This is Dick Cheney, the Antichrist, the brains behind the neocon death cult, saw a weakness because Democrats can't just say, hey, that's just Howard talking. Just Howard. You know, just let Howard talk. You know, he's one of us. So you leave our side. Our flank is open for the evil vice president to say, quote, so far I think he's probably helped us more than he has them. God, you know, and this is because we had to, you know, bicker amongst ourselves. We had these centricrats in the Democratic Party, these people that are borderline Republicans who are too worried about their careers, who say things about Howard Dean, who create tension and create a schism within the Democrats and allow the vice president, not allow him, but almost like we don't need to leave ourselves open to that kind of crap. It upsets me. But he did say there was Howard Dean in response says, people want us to fight. And that's a quote from Howard Dean. And this is regular people. This is real people who donate money to the DNC through the grassroots interneting of just folks. All right. Some of the people he's referring to when he says people want us to fight were the 40 Democratic National Committee leaders who met on Saturday in a hotel in Washington, D.C., and urged him to keep fighting despite a flap over his blunt comments to Republicans. He told them, I'm quoting Howard Dean here, we are not going to lie down in front of the Republican machine anymore, end quote. And he shouted this. Now, this is a great thing because it seems to me that these grassroots efforts, that, you know, a lot of the money that he is collecting, which is, you know, a phenomenal thing. Early in the last cycle, in 2001, the Republican National Committee outraised the Democratic National Committee by 3-1 margin. So far this year, that ratio has been cut to 2-1. And more important is the way it was raised. In the past, the party relied on soft money from millionaires, but such donations are, you know, now, of course, illegal. Now, officials estimate that $12 million of the $14 million that Dean has raised has come from people who have donated less than $250. These are just regular people. So Dean's got a plan. He knows that the big money cats, the fat cats, the millionaires, where are they going to go? There's only one Democratic Party. So, you know, that money's going to come. What does he have to, you know, go around, you know, kissing up to them right now? So right now he's traveled to like 22 states. He's visiting Democratic committees in all these states. He's trying to, you know, organize on a grassroots level, get people involved. And out of the $14 million, $12 million was collected from people donating less than $250. That's amazing. That's that is doing what the Republicans did without all the weird sort of psycho Christo-fascist zombie brigade manipulating of things, without mobilizing fanatics. These are people that believe in the democratic values, and Dean is reaching out to them on a statewide level. He's actually doing what Democrats are supposed to do. He's actually doing what a politician who represents the people is supposed to do, instead of sitting there in Washington condescending to your own and leaving the flank open for the vice president, the evilest man, the most evil, to take a shot at us, several, on television. Thank God for Howard Dean. 16 past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday. Air America Radio.
Morning's edition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here. Mark Riley is away until, I guess, he's come back to Wednesday. I don't want to say where he is, but he's somewhere down south where he gets to dance with large puppets and his family. Yeah? I don't want to make anyone upset. Hey, quit plugging Disney World, man. That's what I get. That's what I get. Quick plug in Disney World. I'm Mark Maron. It's Morning's Edition. Did I say that already? It's nice to see you, Kalo. It's nice to see everybody. P.W. McDonald. It's sometimes weekends, you know, when you work these hours, boy, weekends, you really go away, don't you? Mm-hmm. You know, where it's sort of like, I'm just going to sleep. I don't want to. Yeah. The weekend was very nice. You know, I slept. I cooked. My wife came in. It was beautiful. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy it's Monday. So let's get into some of this stuff. I got Rod Nordland coming up. You know, he's Newsweek Magazine's former Baghdad bureau chief. He's been there for a couple years. He's leaving. You know, his time there is done, and we're going to talk to Rod to reflect. Also, later in the show, for those of you, this is what we call a deep tease in the business, but I know some of you hang on or might want to check back in with us. Gerald Nadler, a congressman from New York, is going to be on our show in the 8 o'clock hour to discuss what happened on Friday, because you know, he was really the star of that. I mean, on Friday, June 10th, during a House Judiciary meeting dealing with the provisions of the Patriot Act that are going to sunset, i.e. no longer be allowed or legal to enact come the end of the year. Now, during that House Judiciary meeting, the chairman of the committee, James Sensenbrenner, Republican congressman from Wisconsin, walked off with the gavel like an angry man-child before Democrats could even voice their opinions and dissent. And as it stands now, within the Patriot Act, the cops, the feds, the Bureau of Tobacco and Firearms can do roving wiretaps. They can obtain library records and bookstore purchases without telling you. They can search your home without telling you. They can accuse you of being a terrorist if you stand outside with a sign they don't like in a legitimate act of civil disobedience. Which, you know, and this means me. You know, we talked to somebody last week, Kayla, where it's sort of like, you know, they can manipulate information however they want. Right? Not unlike the way the neocon death cult justified the Iraq invasion through cherry-picked intelligence from the CIA and the FBI, along with muscling the Brits to do the same, which has become apparent in the Downing Street memo, and now this briefing paper that came out from a meeting of Tony Blair's inner circle about on July 23rd, 2002, that encouraged the government to justify the legality of the invasion. This stuff's just now coming out. Why couldn't the feds take some information from you, Kalo, just to, like, say, all right, where's he gone to lunch? What has he bought? What library books did he check out? When was the last time he went to the library? What books did he buy? How hard would it be to make them some sort of criminal profile?
Right? So easy.
Yeah, and given that this is the case with the Patriot Act, almost anyone could end up indefinitely and illegally detained at Guantanamo Bay or some other similar facility without any substantial legal evidence or accusations against them.
That's terrifying.
It is. And then we, you know, somebody like us could be abused and tortured. Now, this was the point that the Democrats, you know, who were calling the hearing on Friday, were trying to make. They call this meeting under a special rule. They want to effectively question the constitutionality of the Patriot Act. The witnesses the Democrats brought together included Amnesty International USA and the American Immigration Lawyers Association. I mean, this is the last thing that James Sensenbrenner and the other Republican defenders of the Patriot Act on the committee wanted to do was hear what they characterized as inappropriate comments relating to Guantanamo from Democrats because they were trying to change the context. They're like, we're talking about the Patriot Act here. We don't want to talk about Guantanamo. What is it with you Democrats and Guantanamo? They obviously they can make the connection, but they didn't want to talk about it. So Congressman Sensenbrenner took his toy gavel and huffed out of the room, leaving Democrats baffled at his like immature, unprofessional behavior.
And he also shut the lights on them.
Shut the mics and the lights.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's ridiculous.
Who does that?
Who does children?
Exactly.
Children do
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
And these guys, you know, they're always talking about how liberals are whiny or Democrats are babies. But this is the type of tantrum. This is the type of, you know, childish behavior that, you know, that it's got Nancy Pelosi saying, look, you know, that it was another example of the Republicans' abuse of power. You know, and she wants Denny Hastert, House Speaker Denny Hastert, to order an apology. And Gerald Nadler raised a point of decency, as they say in the legislative game, a house of decency to allow Chip Pitts from Amnesty International to make a statement. I saw footage of this, man. It was uncomfortable because, you know, what the Democrats were talking about needed to be heard. It should have been on the record. Right. So this guy storms out like a child. A couple other Republicans, blah, blah, blah. And they start screaming. Exactly. Right. And then, you know, Gerald Nadler is sitting there. And he says, well, you know, point of decency, you know, I'm going to facilitate that, you know, that Chip Pitts is allowed to talk from Amnesty International, make the comments that he can make. And you could see on the footage, on the TV, that they turned the mics off and they were going on and off. And Gerald Nadler, Congressman Nadler, who will be with us in the 8 o'clock hour, had to, you know, make his statement with sound going in and out and enable Chip Pitts to make his statement. Jabe Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, said after the outburst, quote, I'm troubled about what lesson this gives the rest of the world, end quote. This is one of the bigger problems that I have is that, you know, I saw it, so that means people in Europe are seeing it. And it's the same feeling I had with the Shivo circus is that, you know, aren't we embarrassed? Aren't we embarrassed that Europe is going to see us like this? And not that, you know, I'm just talking about a balance of things. I'm not saying that Europe's better than us or not better than us, but we are supposed to be an example. We are supposed to be, you know, a functioning, you know, beacon of light in terms of democratic rule. And now we're turning in this horrendous neocon death cult. Fascist, you know, and I don't like to use the word fascist, but it's starting to stink like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially when you see this type of behavior on behalf of Republican legislators that's on television. What a child. I just felt like I had a Springer moment. I can't tell you. And now there's also, we got...
I didn't know Springer had moments.
Woo! He's got his picture's on a phone kiosk in Queens.
Because I love Jerry Springer like he was my father.
Dude, I had to do that. It was a compromise I had to make.
You were
I was
at
in
gunpoint,
trouble.
Apparently.
I kind of was at gunpoint. But, you know, there is something interesting happening is that some Republicans are siding with Democrats and with the ACLU in some respects about Guantanamo. And some Republicans are also saying it's time to get out of Iraq. You know, we're going to cover that stuff with Rod Nordwin from Newsweek magazine. He's the Baghdad bureau chief, and he's leaving Baghdad. And that's coming up next. So stay with us. It's a big show this morning, 27 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Mark Riley on vacation for just a couple more days. We were talking about James Sensenbrenner storming out of the hearing on Friday. We'll get into more of that in just a minute about what they want to do, why he felt so empowered to do that around the provisions in the Patriot Act that are supposed to wear out or go bad or sunset at the end of the year, and how the Bush administration and the Republicans on the Senate Intelligence Committee want to expand the Patriot Act. There are some Republicans who are against it. Some true Republicans were against the Patriot Act because of its intrusion and expansion of government. And also there are some true Republicans who are beginning to say, look, the Iraq thing's out of control. Even though Cheney said that the insurgents are in their last throes, some Republicans are no longer able to manage the lie for reasons of reality breaking through. And they've started to speak out. These are Republicans like Representative Walter Jones from North Carolina, Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Congressman Kurt Weldon from Pennsylvania, Senator Chuck Hagel from Nebraska. There's a couple of things that really sum it up. I mean, Lindsey Graham. First of all, you know, Congressman Walter Jones of North Carolina was the guy who came up with the freedom fries thing. And this is a guy that's now, he says he wants to offer legislation next week setting a timetable for the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina said the insurgency is alive and well. We underestimated the viability of the insurgency. He also said, quote, because of this war, it's going sour in terms of word of mouth from parents and grandparents in terms of recruiting for the Army. He said, quote, if we don't adjust, public opinion is going to keep slipping away, end quote. So what's happened is the people are waking up to the reality of the BS that's been coming out of the mouths of these Republicans, and now they're trying to kiss up and make nice to the voters they sold out for party loyalty. And we have somebody who's going to at least tell us what the reality is on the ground there. Our next guest spent the past 2 years as Newsweek magazine's Baghdad bureau chief and joins us now by phone from London, England. Please welcome Rod Nordland. Good morning, Rod.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. You say in your piece, which ran last week in Newsweek magazine, that initially, I don't know if you still are, we're behind the U.S. going in to Iraq to topple Saddam Hussein. Why did you feel that way, and how do you feel now?
Well, I never really believed in the WMD fairy tale, but I had been to Iraq quite often before. I had friends there, and I'd seen the kind of things that Iraqis suffered through. And I was, frankly, very, very much in favor of the idea of toppling Saddam Hussein on his own merits. And I felt that most Iraqis would welcome us with open arms, and things would go quite well. And I was as deluded as apparently the American government was. They had less excuse.
So you believe in that part of the fairy tale, anyways? The part where we were going to get flowers and showered with thanks.
I still think that would have happened if we hadn't screwed it up so badly in so many ways from the first days that we entered the country.
And I'm also assuming that, you know, given that you knew it was a fairy tale, maybe I knew it was a fairy tale, the presentation of that fairy tale about WMDs to the American people was wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's an old issue. I mean,
sure. I don't dismiss it too easily. So looking back, do you think that what could we have done if you said that it could have went better? What do you think should have happened?
Well, I think first there were lots of mistakes, and the first biggest mistake was not to send enough troops to do the job properly. So we had this invasion force that was far too small, even by the U.S. military's own estimates, to secure the country and maintain the peace and control the rear as the army advanced forward. So what they did was very effectively and with great efficiency, raced up to Baghdad and leaving the rest of the country in ruins without a police force or any kind of civil security. And the result was widespread looting that did two things. One, it disenchanted Iraqis because they felt that the American army was capable of doing better. It created a lot of discord and cost a lot of people their lives and their property. It destroyed institutions and everything from schools to factories and public places, and made the job of reconstruction that much bigger. But probably the longest lasting effect of that policy was that it persuaded most Iraqis that our intentions were not good in Iraq, that we were there to steal the oil and didn't care about anything else. This most widely believed kind of urban myth from that time was that U.S. troops protected only the oil ministry and not any other buildings in Baghdad, which wasn't true, but it's widely believed.
And because of that disenchantment, you get a lot of regular Iraqis who are not necessarily aligned with the jihadist ideology or Sunni ideology who became despondent and entered the insurgency. Is that true?
Yes, but that didn't happen right away. After April 2003, after the invasion, there was no insurgency. For several months, until really late summer, there was hardly any insurgency at all. But then the other mistake was that we didn't have enough troops to do the job, and we didn't have a plan for how to take over and how to run things. And that left everything in such disarray that the insurgency was able to reorganize itself, or Saddam's Ba'athist Party followers and so on were able to organize themselves into an insurgency to find the weapons they need to establish lines of communication and so forth.
All right, so now that chaos persists, it seems to me, from what I'm seeing in the information I'm gathering, and We have on our hands a real guerrilla war, and there's no indication that the training of Iraqi forces is going to be effective in the near future. And I'm not hearing you say, and I guess I haven't asked you, if there is, there doesn't seem to be a strategy to get out or even, you know, wrangle this thing into some sort of working order, to the point where Republican legislators, on the behest of their constituencies, are saying, let's get out. What do you see as the future in the country?
I'm sorry, how long do we have? 5 minutes? Or half an hour?
Yeah, well, I guess why don't we just stick with the idea of an exit strategy. Is there one?
There is no exit strategy.
Okay.
There wasn't a plan in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They kept talking about, you know, we have a plan. There is a plan. In fact, there never was a plan, and not one that was in any kind of form they could implement. And there isn't an exit strategy beyond the idea of training the Iraqi forces until they get to the point where they can actually take over. But that may be many, many years, and that, I guess, is what amounts to our exit strategy, but it's not much of one.
So Rod Nordland, Baghdad bureau chief of Newsweek magazine, as you leave Baghdad, you know, what are your feelings? Are you happy to leave? Are you going to miss it?
Well, I'm going to miss the story. It's a great story and a really important one, and one that you can feel proud of being part of. I'm mostly relieved that I'm still alive after 2 years there, and very disenchanted with how badly things have gone and how much worse they've gotten. In those 2 years, I can honestly say I've seen nothing. You know, with one or two exceptions, things have gotten worse all the time.
Did you have a specific incidents where you feared for your life many times?
Many times, yes. And I'm a pretty cautious person, and I,
mm-hmm.
it was more the fact that because of the risk, I would not do things that I very much wanted to do and not move around as much as I would like to move.
Yeah, we heard that from many press people who were over there, that a lot of people assume that that you guys are being restricted, but at times it was just a safety issue. It was impossible to go out on the streets. It was my impression.
That's right. I mean, most journalists in Iraq, most foreign journalists, do not go out at all except to go from whatever bunker they're in, or hotel bunker, to another bunker somewhere in the green zone, where they go to press conferences where people are searched 3 to 5 times before they get into the building.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the same goes for going to government offices and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You can go to government offices. You can talk to Iraqis, you know, in the green zone and so on, and in a few other places that are heavily guarded. But what you can't do is get out on the street and talk to common people.
Where, as you
like to.
Sure. And as you leave, is there any, you know, it sounds pretty hopeless on some levels. Is there anything changing on the ground there that you can see that could provide any hope or any progress in terms of either the people in Iraq or rebuilding or anything?
No.
Okay.
It's a short answer. I mean, maybe a more thoughtful answer would be that there have been some good things that have happened.
Mm-hmm.
The elections on January 30th were a tremendous success and widely supported by all Iraqis, with the exception of Sunni Arabs, who either boycotted or were afraid to go to the polls. And most Sunni Arab leaders now recognize that was a mistake, and they should have participated. But against that is what's happened since. It took them more than 3 months to form a government,
mm-hmm.
and it was very much a compromise government that nobody's very happy with. And they have now only about a month and a half left to finish writing the Constitution, or decide to delay writing the Constitution for another 6 months, something
wow.
nobody wants.
Mm-hmm.
And the prospects of them getting a Constitution now are very, very poor on that schedule.
Do you think that there's one more question, but I heard reports that there have been secret meetings with the representatives from the U.S. and with the insurgents' representatives. Do you know anything about that?
I believe that that's true. I think it's not so much direct representatives of the insurgents, but rather Sunni Arab leaders who
mm-hmm.
have contacts amongst the insurgents. And there are many different groups now involved and
mm-hmm.
different types of groups, and
mm-hmm.
some of them want to talk and,
mm-hmm.
and be part of the political process.
Yeah.
They are the Iraqi groups, but not all of them. But the hardcore of the insurgency isn't talking. They're aligning now with Al-Qaeda and you know, the whole foreign jihadi movement, and they have a much bigger goal even than defeating the Americans in Iraq, and that's to provoke a world war between Islam and the West.
We're talking to Rod Nordland, Newsweek magazine's former Baghdad bureau chief, on his way out of Iraq. Do you think we're just going to cut and run? Do you think, not cut and run, do you think we're just going to pull out and leave chaos there, and you think that's the only option at this point?
I don't even think that's an option. I guess it's a possibility, but it would be disastrous, and I think most Iraqis on all sides realize that. I even talked to quite anti-American Sunni Arabs who you know, at the end of the day, don't want to see the Americans leave too quickly. They want to see them leave, but they realize that if they leave too quickly, there's one solution for the insurgency that hasn't been tried yet and would definitely work, and that is the Hamas solution. You know, you kill 5 million Sunni Arabs and you have no insurgency left.
Right.
And that's something that could definitely happen in a civil war scenario, and they realize that.
Wow. Grim stuff, but Rod Nordland, I'm glad you're safe. Thank you for reporting on this stuff, and you know, take care of yourself.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, take care. That was Rod Nordland, Newsweek magazine's former Baghdad bureau chief, leaving Iraq with some heavy, disconcerting news. We will be back with, we're going to finish talking about James Sensenbrenner running away, huffing out of the room like a baby, and also we have the liberal agenda. So stay with us. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Hi, this is Congressman Gerald Nadler from New York's 8th District, and you're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Morning's Sedition, Air America Radio.
Sky. 51 past the hour, Mark Maron here, Mark Riley on vacation. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. There's a Riley. We got some Riley on tape. Give me another one. Oh, nope. All right, we'll take the facts. It's all right. This is the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. This is our weekly rundown of the things that are important. So these are your marching orders for this week, I guess. One, point out that in German, Sensenbrenner means huffy, cheating, wussy man. That's one translator's take on it. Two, it's hurricane season again. See if the Weather Service will name one Howard or Dean. How would that be? Huh? Nothing? All right. Three, suggest the government close Guantanamo and convert it into a brew pub with regular folk music and comedy nights. What do you think? Huh? All right. Four, the FBI is spying on the left wing, so from time to time during the day, drop your pants and dance around. They'll see it. Do it at work. Come on, live a little. It's Monday. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Screw the Live Aid concerts. White musicians shouldn't be helping those who are starving. White musicians should be the ones who are starving. Wake up, sheeple. It's cultural genocide, and it started with Elvis, man.
Yeah.
That's a classic Riley.
I drip steam like a microphone fiend.
That's a more classic Riley. I wonder if you know he might be up. Do we go into are we in Orlando? Nah, maybe not.
But
we're everywhere else, though.
You could be streaming.
Right. Yeah.
What do you think Riley's doing? Like, what's his favorite ride? Like, teacups?
Riley's not going to be going on anything that involves, you know, like, sitting in something that moves.
Oh, okay, so he'll be in, like, the Epcot big ball thing.
Right, but what he'll be doing is a lot of waving. There's, hi, Vivica, you know. All right, so I just want to, you know, I want to say that we're going to be covering this story throughout the day. It's not that it hasn't been covered, but it hasn't been covered by us. Last Friday's judiciary meeting dealing with provisions of the Patriot Act that are going to run out at the end of the year, Congressman James Sensenbrenner left. He walked off like a child, took his gavel, and just stormed out of the room, leaving Congressman Gerald Nadler to facilitate Chip Pitts from Amnesty International statements. Gerald Nadler is going to be calling us in the 8 o'clock hour if you want to stick around for that. But I want to, you know, before we move into that that story and talk about it in detail, I just want to tell you why Sensenbrenner felt empowered to do what he did. Okay, he felt entitled and empowered to act the way he did because the president and the Senate Intelligence Committee want the Patriot Act not just preserved, but expanded to give the feds the ability to subpoena almost any kind of personal records they want, including your mail, folks, without any judicial review whatsoever, i.e. no warrant needed and it's legal. They're going to sort through so much crap in my box, I'll tell you right now. If they're going to go through my mail, they're going to, I mean, while they're at it, if this was a government for the people, I just want to say one thing. They would prosecute credit card companies for the hundreds of predatory lending scams that they'll be coming across on a day-to-day basis. If this were the right, if this was really a government for the people. Yeah? You know what I'm saying, man?
Yep.
I'm panicky, dude. I'm a little panicky.
About what?
Because this mad cow thing.
Mad cow? You don't eat meat.
I know that.
You have nothing. You literally have nothing to worry about.
But you know the shelf life in your brain of that thing? Of Creutzfeldt-Jakob ailment syndrome?
Okay,
yeah.
So what? You're thinking it's like a time bomb in your body right now?
Yeah, I'll be honest with you.
Away?
I'll be honest with you. Yeah, that could be anything. If someone could explain this spot on my arm, I'd be helpful. That'd be helpful. Can you tell me what that is? Where'd that come from? What do you make of that? You know, how long is it going to be before I go to the doctor to check out the spot on my arm? I'm one of these, I don't know when I became this guy. I used to be a guy who would go to the doctor.
You talk to a dermatologist to fix that.
I'm going to go to a dermatologist. P.W. McDonald got me a dermatologist number. But I used to be the guy that as soon as anything felt wrong, I'd go to the doctor that day. Now I've become the guy, it's like, I'll just wait and see if it goes away and if it spreads or changes color. You know, maybe I'll go see somebody. Because a lot of times stuff goes away. You know, am I wrong?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, you know, thank God I'm right.
Things go into remission.
Here's the mad cow thing that bothers me, is that they think they might have a cow that has it. It's not a dairy cow like the other American cow that was born in Canada that they decided and proved to have mad cow. This is a beef cow that they tested once, you know, like in November. And then they said, yeah, he might have it. He came up positive, but this could be a false positive. And then they put the cow back, I guess, into this special quarantine pen. And now they decided not to to cut it up because it's what they call it, what is it called, a droopy cow or a downy cow or, you know, a tired cow.
So,
well, anyway.
So you know, there's a possibility. So they didn't cut it up and make it into meat.
Yeah, I know, but why not just get rid of it? But here's the thing is that, okay, so now he might have it, but the USD, the Department of Agriculture, is saying there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, don't worry about it. There might be two other cows that might have it, but, you know, one of them tested positive, but we're testing them again, and we're going to send parts of them to England for really super special testing. But don't worry about it. There's nothing to worry about. Now, this is like after a week of, you know, the tobacco company lying to the American public about the health concerns of tobacco in order to sell their product. The meat industry, if you read, like, anything, like Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation, and just read how the meat industry works, if there's one cow or two cows in this country that have this thing, which I assume there are, dude, it's. I mean, I don't want to alarm anybody, all right. But you know, this the way they're obfuscating and the way they're sort of juggling facts, like, well, yeah, this meat might have it. It tested once, but that wasn't a really good test. We're going to send it to England. They're sort of confusing the story already. They're saying go ahead and have a steak, but the one thing that they can't deny is that this thing is here. And at the very last part of this story, they're like, but we don't know where the cow was born. So hopefully they'll be able to find another country to blame for this mad cow disease.
By the way, I made a great cheeseburger this past weekend.
Yeah, was it good?
Oh, Munster cheese. It was fantastic.
Medium rare?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good for you.
It was good. Really good.
Hey, what are the odds, really? You know, everyone, you got to gamble a little bit. You know what I mean? You know, if you really need a condom, come on. 45 past the hour. No, 57 past the hour. We'll talk to you in a minute. Air America Radio. That's right, it's 6 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, Mark Riley, on vacation, perhaps having some breakfast, maybe a waffle shaped like Mickey Mouse's head. I don't know, he's down there in Florida doing the Mickey Mouse thing with his daughter and wife. I am here doing this thing. I hope you're okay. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, with no sense of humor. Lurking conservatives, thank you all who came down to the Strand Bookstore last Friday. We had a great time. I got some, some people brought some very nice presents. I got some buttons that people, I can't remember her name, but I have it, I will announce it. I feel big. Someone gave me some Wake Up Sheeple buttons and some Philosopher Kings and Queens, but I'll bring them in tomorrow and talk about that then. Later in the show, we've got Congressman Gerald Nadler, who was the star of the House Judiciary Committee's 11th hearing on the U.S. Patriot Act since April. The Democrats requested it, and James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin stormed out like a baby because he didn't want to hear about Guantanamo from representatives from Amnesty International and some other people, and specifically Chip Pitts from Amnesty International, who wanted to speak his piece. He just stormed out, took his gavel and left like a child. Right when he decided it was time to end the meeting. And Gerald Nadler was left there on the dais sitting by himself, and Sensenbrenner was turning the lights off. They tried to cut the mics on and off, and Nadler said, as a point of decency, which is a legislative term for, you know, that guy just acted like an idiot, like an unprofessional idiot, James Sensenbrenner, storming out like a child, because he's empowered by the neocon death cults who want the Patriot Act not only to be maintained and not to run out, but they want it to, you know, they want to expand its power, which is pissing off some real Republicans in terms of government, you know, intrusion onto our lives. But Gerald Nadler sat there and said, as a point of decency, I want Chip Pitts from Amnesty International to say his piece. We're going to talk to Nadler about that in about an hour. So hang out for that. We're going to talk some more about Howard Dean. I want to do a few little fun stories. Is that okay if I can open with that there, Kalo? Pink Floyd is going to, original lineup, going to reconvene for the big concert.
No way.
Yes. The Live 8 concert. The original Pink Floyd.
At Live 8.
Yeah, dig this. Dave Gilmore. He says, quote, any squabbles Roger and the band have had in the past are so petty in this context. And performing for this concert will help focus attention, then it's got to be worthwhile. Any squabbles? These guys make, what do they make? On Dark Side of the Moon alone, this is the original liner from Dark Side of the Moon. They got to make each of them, you know, millions a year. Yeah, so yeah, I think that, you know, you can get together for 2 hours. You know, maybe play a couple of songs for the people. You know, like, how are you supposed to feel bad for, you know what I mean? Like, I hope we can pull it together and not fight for an hour. You know what? You owe it to us. I'd kind of like to see it. Also, you know, according to a memo obtained by the Baltimore Sun, the Army is easing the requirements for junior officer candidates. The age cutoff used to be 29. Now they're looking at applicants as old as 42 years old. We found this ad in the classified section. It's our Morning Sedition Monday job listing, folks. Trade in your midlife crisis for a real crisis. The U.S. Army is looking for, well, frankly, anybody. So right now, we're concentrating on middle-aged guys old enough to remember Rambo and dumb enough to consider it a documentary. Don't be one of those middle-aged losers who try to attract attention by driving a Corvette around town. You could be driving a Humvee around to Crete, attracting all kinds of attention, my friend. Note, armor plating is optional. Hassled by the wife and kids, how'd you like to not see them for about 4 years? How about that? Huh? This could be your chance to reclaim your youth, on the off chance that your youth consisted of dodging shrapnel and ransacking the homes of penniless Arabs. The ideal candidate will be anyone who would consider doing this, even briefly. Just sign the papers during that moment of indecision. Did you do that? Remember, we're the United States Army, and we want you, no matter who you are. Really, please call. Please. Yeah. Looks like New York City has the mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, is committed to cutting a deal with the Mets to build a stadium out where I live, like 5 minutes away, next to Shea Stadium.
Plan B, baby.
Plan B. No stadium on the west side. That thing fell through for a lot of different reasons. Now, a lot of people thought this is where the stadium should be originally.
Of course.
It's out there in Queens. Now, what do I know from it? Do we need a stadium in Queens, Chris?
God, yeah.
Why?
Because the one we have now is a dump. It's falling apart.
Shea Stadium's falling apart?
Yes.
I haven't been there in a long time.
Oh, boy. It's a sad, sad scene.
Yeah. And the Mets are going to be throwing the bill for this to the tune of about $650 million.
That's great. We don't have to pay for it. Let's do it. And that's even better.
There won't be a traffic problem here in Manhattan. If people are coming in from Jersey or Manhattan, they just go over the Triborough down to, you know, follow the Grand Central right there. Bang.
And Mass Transit's already there. You got the LIRR. You have the number 7 train. I mean, it's all there for you.
And there's all those weird, if you want to get your car worked on, there's this little weird little community of junk metal people.
There's like 20 of them.
I know. I don't even understand it. I don't even understand. Right next to Shea Stadium, there's just like this alleyway. It feels like you're in a third world country for metal, for junk metal and welding. They're guys, you know, pulling stuff apart. Huge chunks of metal. My only guy, I have no good memories about Shea Stadium. I was there once. I swear to God, once, Chris.
And
once.
What happened?
I told you the story once. You want me to tell it again?
Yeah.
My grandfather, who, my grandpa Jack, was a genius when it comes to sports. This guy would watch any sport. He knew the rules to any sport. He would lay on the couch. He would watch every sport that was available on television. He would get excited about curling. All right? You know, I remember walking, I'm like, what the hell, what is that even? The guy's on the ice with brooms. And he's like, well, that guy, he's got to get 2 points. I don't even know. He just loved every sport.
Very cool.
Big baseball fan. And I, of course, was not. You know, I was like 7 and I was reading, you know, Allen Ginsberg poetry. So my
weird kid.
I don't know what I was. Mad Magazine. I wasn't reading Allen Ginsberg at 7. That would be weird. Mad Magazine. You know, I don't know. Yeah, I just wanted to be different. So my grandpa decides to take me to see the Mets, Shea Stadium. You know, they lived in New Jersey. We were visiting. I might have even been living there. I lived there when I was a little kid. I can't remember exactly the year. If I was 7, I would have been living there.
Cool.
So we go see the Mets game. He takes me to the Mets game. He's going to turn me on to baseball. He's going to make it happen because, you know, my father, you know, was working. He was never there. That's another issue. All right, so we go. There was no baseball. I think he bought me a mitt, my father, but that was it. Here,
you
learn how
play
to
catch?
Use. Yeah, I played catch with the mitt. He threw it at me and said, learn how to use this. Good luck with that. all right, so, look. So my grandfather takes me to the Mets game. We get there. We sit there for like 9 innings, all right? Nothing happens. The Mets are down. It's over. You know,
okay.
It looks like it's over. And he's like, let's beat the traffic. Okay, so we get in the car. We're driving back to New Jersey. He pops on the radio. It's like, oh, my God, it's a miracle. I've never seen a turnaround like this in my life. The Mets just hit a bases-loaded home run. Who the hell knows? I don't even remember.
Night.
Oh, I don't even remember what it was. But we're sitting in the car, and my grandpa's like, I don't believe this.
Oh,
so
no.
That, combined with getting hit in the nose in center field on Pee Wee Little League, left me, and of course my father being away, I was not, that's why I don't like sports. But are you going to take me to a game or what?
Yeah, I definitely am. A nice day game, so it doesn't interfere with our, schedules.
We can go right after the show.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
Do they schedule games on our schedule? Like,
yeah.
Could we go right after
yeah.
the show?
Usually there's a Wednesday or Thursday day game.
Oh, that's going to be great. Because I can just sit there. I went to a Yankee game with my buddy Louie. I had a pretty good time.
Eh,
but
you have a lot more fun at
Yeah, but see, the thing is, it's like, don't even get mad at me for that. Because I don't even watch it for teams.
I understand.
I just watch it for the, you know, I'm like, oh, he hit it. You know, and then I stand up and everyone's like, sit down, the wrong side. Yeah, but he hit it. It's a good hit. Can't we be supportive?
That's just Yankee Stadium. Shea Stadium's a whole different experience.
It's why? It's garbage?
No, it's just more fun. We're not a lot less loose. You know, Yankee fans, they're a little tight, you know.
Oh, really?
It's very businesslike at Yankee Stadium, you know. Shea Stadium, not so much.
Well, yeah.
Because we know we suck for so long that, you know, we're just trying to have fun.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, it's lucky we're not in California where I used to live on occasion in a moderate earthquake. I like how they say that. A moderate earthquake shook most of Southern California, rattling, everybody's homes. But it's weird when you live in California. You have that moment where you're like, all right, okay, here we go. It's shaking. How long is it going to go? All right. Okay, that's it. That's it. All right, we're okay. Everybody okay? Good.
Oof,
let's go
scary.
To work. It is scary, man.
What was the earthquake over near your house?
No, apparently the house is still there.
Oh, good. It didn't fall down
the
hill.
Did you know, my wife told me that most of those houses that, like, slid down the hill in those mudslides were new houses?
Really?
My house was built in 1927. My house has seen, like, 3 or 4 earthquakes, you know, torrential rains. It just sits there like a rock. It's not even anchored, as they say.
That's the biggest selling point right there.
What, that it's not anchored?
No. It's gone
survived.
Through all this stuff, nothing has happened to it.
This house has survived.
Oh.
And they try to get you to anchor it because it's this racket. It's an insurance racket where you can pay extra. These old houses aren't anchored, which means that they're not drilled into the earth that might shift. Now, what the hell is the point of that? Anyways, look, you know, I'm wasting people's Monday morning time here a little bit. I want you to have a good Monday morning. I want to give you some more information about some stuff. We're going to come back and talk about exciting mad cow disease. And we're also going to talk about Howard Dean a little bit and get into some specifics about James Sensenbrenner, certainly with Gerald Nadler, Congressman from New York, in the 8 o'clock hour if you're in for the long haul. So stay with us. All that's coming up next here on Air America Radio's Mornings Edition. I'm Mark Maron. It's 16 past the hour.
Mornings Edition on the air and online. MorningsEdition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark. Riley's not here. He's not here. He's in Disney World. Not plugging Disney World, just plugging where Riley is. Hope he's having a good time. He'll be back soon, a couple days. I think Wednesday he's coming back. He's down there with his family. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Right now, guess what, folks? It's that time. Thank God we got the machine back from the Strand. We left it down there. We had to send someone over the weekend to pick it up. What are you laughing at? I'm serious. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. And that's why we have the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. So what do you say we kick it up? Let's translate some headlines. The New York Times says, a report by U.S. criticizing U.N. urges reforms. A report by U.S. criticizing U.N. urges reforms. Translation, reforms include demolishing U.N. for new East Side Stadium. What do you think? Let's try another one. U.S. criticizing U.N. urges reforms. U.S. threatens U.N. with a stern Boltonization. Yeah, first one was better, wasn't it? What are you going to do? From Fox News. Gas prices continue to fall. Gas prices continue to fall. Translation, Saudis softening market in preparation for spectacular July 4th freedom gouging. Oh, boy. All right. Happy Monday. From Associated Press, most states let drivers exceed speed limit. Most states let drivers exceed speed limit. Translation, administration's total lawlessness trickles down. Trickles down. Maybe if I read that at the end, if I lifted it a little bit. What do you think? Wait, hold on, Jim. Jim's in here. I'll introduce him in a minute. Let me tell you. Administration's total lawlessness trickles down. Oh, my God. How about this? Wait. You know what? Forget it.
Maybe there's something wrong.
What were you going to say, Jim Earl?
Maybe there's something wrong with the machine.
Yes. That must be it. That must be it. Folks, I'd like to introduce you to one of our writers and a creator of many of your favorite characters. Jim Earl is in the studio with us. He was down there Friday at the Strand. We had a good time. You're going to come down, too, in a couple weeks, a week from this Friday. I'm afraid to plug it because I don't want people showing up this Friday. But June 24th, we're going to be at the Park Slope, Brooklyn location, the Tea Lounge. That is June 24th. Write that on your little calendars.
Where is that?
Put in your Blackberries. It's in Brooklyn. It's in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Okay, there must be some sort of street address.
What do you want from me? Well, we'll get the street address as we get closer to it. We don't want to baffle people, Jim. You know what I mean? It's 2 weeks away. It's like it's almost 2 weeks away. I'm going to be performing at Bananas Comedy Club. Do you hear that, Jim?
Really?
Bananas Comedy Club in New Jersey.
I bet the people go nuts there.
Yeah, they go nuts at Bananas. That's on June 25th.
Really?
Yeah. Well, you know why
are they charging for that show?
Yes, they're going to be charging, and we're going to be giving away tickets at the Tea Lounge. And you're going to come out? You should open for me.
Yeah. Sure. Well, you know, why don't I bring back the rest of the I-5 9000 jokes for you? So maybe you can deliver them correctly.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll do that in a second. But first, the reason I wanted you to be in here is to bum everybody out about the environment. Because
first of all, before you say something like that, it's nothing more positive than bringing out the issue of the environment and how it's totally in the toilet and we have no hope.
Yeah, the no hope part is essentially, that was really the hook on that one.
Yeah, that's positive.
No, positive is talking about it. We're going to be talking about it with Betsy Rosenberg, who is the host of EcoTalk, and she's going to talk to us about, you know, Tony Blair's statement about the environment is the most important thing. We're also going to talk a little bit about the Bush administration allowing a former oil industry lobbyist to rewrite climate change reports. How about that? Huh? How about that? And I'm talking about some other important issues. But you, your brother's a politician of sorts. He's a Green candidate for, yeah.
For Huntington Beach City Council. He ran a very, very, very tight campaign.
Did he win?
No.
Oh. But you are, every time that we talk, every time we bring up anything, anytime we talk about anything on this show, for 3 hours, you can say to me, like, all you should be talking about is the environment. And perhaps you're right, but that's sort of a different show. So now you have your chance. There's Mad Cow on the horizon as well.
None of this matters. Yeah. Nothing that you're talking about matters the slightest bit.
You mean anything that I've ever said on this show, that doesn't matter?
Well, unless you're talking about, see, the environment is right on the top there. That should be the priority of every political commentator and comic.
Yeah.
Comic. Because none of these other issues matter, you know, if we're going to be fighting each other over fresh water and clean air. And, you know, if I have to buy a 20-odd six to fight you off for,
for
clean
water. Sure, yeah. Sure. You know what I'm starting to understand is that, you know, the characters are really a good outlet for you. No, I'm kidding, man. I think you're right, but it's interesting how you always go to the scenario, like the sort of Mad Max scenario.
Scientists are delivering horrible news to us every other week.
I know.
About 50 years.
I know.
One third of the mammal population of the world is going to be gone.
I know.
50% of all birds are going to be gone.
I know.
You
are going to be gone.
I'm going to be gone, but your children will be here.
I'm not
cursing your memory.
I don't have any kids. But who knows? Maybe at that point they'll be adapting and they'll have all kinds of weird things. Like, you know, they'll adapt these weird meals.
Right. Maybe your children will adapt to be funny.
Whoa. I think the environment is very important. No, don't worry about hurting my feelings.
Wait.
We're going to be back with the Mortensen's Morning Remember, so we're going to have to go in the hall to find him. And Betsy Rosenberg, host of EcoTalk, will talk to us, you know, sincerely and earnestly, as Jim did, about the environment, which I do think is important. So that's coming up next here on Air America Radio. I'm Mark Maron. This is Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here, Mark Riley on vacation. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Momentarily, we will be talking to Betsy Rosenberg, the host of Eco Talk here on Air America, which airs every Sunday from 7 to 8 a.m. www.ecotalkblog.com is the email. Or actually, the website. That's what it is, the newfangled technology stuff. We also have a Morning Remembrance with Mort Mortensen coming up momentarily. In getting into this environmental segment that we're going to be talking about, I would like to say that it came out on Saturday that Philip Cooney, who was chief of staff of the White House Council on Environmental Quality, a former oil industry lobbyist who changed government reports on global warming, has resigned. It is said that it is a long-planned departure, but it's a little ironic that he resigns days after he gets called on rewriting and revising these scientific reports. And by way of introduction for Betsy, I want to play Al Gore speaking at the World Environmental Day conference in San Francisco 2 weeks ago. Let's hear that.
Is it only terrorists that we're worried about? Is that the only threat that is worth our attention? We are witnessing a collision between our civilization and the Earth. Properly understood, this is a planetary emergency. The problem is worse than the scientific community thought it was even 10 years ago, significantly worse. The solutions are more accessible than people ever thought they were. We can do this.
That was Al Gore speaking at the World Environmental Day conference in San Francisco 2 weeks ago. Philip Cooney, the former oil industry lobbyist who changed government reports, just by, you know, this is an example of a sentence that Philip Cooney would cut out of a report that he sent up the stream to the White House. Quote, "Warming will also cause reductions in mountain glaciers and advance the timing of the melt of mountain snowpacks in polar regions. There will be significant shifts in the seasonality of runoff that will have serious impacts on native populations that rely on fishing and hunting for their livelihood. These changes will be further complicated by shifts in precipitation regimes and a possible intensification and increased frequency of extreme hydrologic events. That whole paragraph excised because he says restrained from research strategy and the speculative findings. Now, on the phone with us to clear some of this stuff up, Betsy Rosenberg, host of Air America's EcoTalk. Good morning, Betsy.
Good morning. Now, why would Philip Cooney do this? He was only the former lobbyist for the American Petroleum Institute. You tell me.
Exactly. I mean, what was he even doing in that position? But what I want to know is it they kept saying it's part of normal procedure. My first reaction is that can't be possible. I mean, I'm assuming that editing might be, but not like that, right?
I think it is part of normal procedure, Mark, and I think that's why we're in this mess.
Mm-hmm.
This is not taken seriously. I had Myron E. Bell on. He was quoted in the article that you were just quoting from.
Who is he?
He's with his libertarian group, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Uh-huh.
He basically was defending this action.
Mm.
He calls, you know, this alarmist scientist. He keeps science, rather. He keeps referring to that. This is all the evidence that we have. It's there mounting every day. Alarmist science.
That's what science is for, to speculate on the facts.
Right, right. Mm. He says that this happened even under Clinton, that they would, edit documents. Well, if it did happen under Clinton and Gore, and it probably did to some extent because, you know, they're all always involved in the spin machine, they are, you know, sacrificing our children's future. You know, shame on them, all of them. But obviously it is far, far worse with this administration. And coming, you know, on the heels of this incredible week-long World Environment Day conference,
mm-hmm.
with Al Gore just setting everyone on fire. You heard, I'm glad you played that quote.
Yeah.
You tell people, you know, Gore was passionate. He was compelling. You said, people look at you like, Al Gore. But, you know, it was 45 minutes of what you just played.
He also said there are ways that we can fix it, Betsy. Can you tell me some of those ways that he suggested?
Well, first of all, we need to take our heads out of the sand, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We need to, I mean, when people ask me what's our biggest environmental problem in your view, I say ignorance, you know, and it starts with this administration. But we don't do such a good job of educating, you know, the public in general. Mainstream media is really missing the boat, is really missing.
And you're also fighting with people who get up in the morning and say, it looks okay today, it looks okay outside. I mean, the sad thing about a lot of people is that, you know, until everyone gets up on one morning and no one can breathe at the same time, they can't take any action.
And you know what? At that point, it'll probably be too late.
I'm thinking.
But that's how we are as a country. You know, it's just when our backs are up against the wall, when there's a crisis. The problem is if you, you know, read anything about this issue, and this is the mother of all environmental issues. We have other ones underneath it. But as that guy, Jim Earle, he's great. Jim.
He's got a question for you, I think, Jim. Say hi to Betsy Rosenberg.
Hi, Betsy. It's real nice to meet you.
You too.
You got a question?
I have a question. Yeah, why is it taking Tony Blair and Al Gore to come to say this, so long to say something like this, at this intensity?
I think because we enter the second Bush administration and we see that things are not going to get any better, obviously, that this issue, you know, which, you know, is the big one, we can't afford to play politics with this. You know, there's a lot of things that swing back, you know, the pendulum back and forth. There's a lot of things that are reversible. You know, Mother Nature, the law of physics, is not reversible. And if you listen to any of the people who are working on this issue, it's later than we think. If we'd signed on to Kyoto, if Kyoto goes into effect full force, it's almost still too late. That's sort of the bad news. But if we don't wake up and take our heads out of the sand, as our theme song on EcoTalk says, it's going to be a whole lot worse.
Now, there's a group of mayors that have put together a coalition here in the States to sign on to Kyoto as cities. Isn't that true?
That's right. There's now 161 mayors from U.S. cities who have signed on to their own Kyoto initiative. So cities are taking action. Citizens are taking action. If you go to a website, stopglobalwarming.org, it's a virtual march on global warming. More than 60,000 people have signed on to that. So, you know, Tony Blair gets it, Al Gore gets it, mayors get it. They're not all alarmists.
What about this?
Is not an alarmist. John McCain is not an alarmist.
Right. What about this guy you spoke to on the show from the Union of Concerned Scientists?
It was actually a woman, a
mm-hmm.
scientist, and she just, you know, countered Myron E. Bell's, you know, they keep saying, the naysayers, or as Bobby Kennedy calls them, the biostitute,
mm-hmm.
that this is part of a natural, you know, phenomenon, that we have had warming, you know, back to the Dark Ages. That's what Myron Avell said, you know, to which I said, well, yeah, and so we're still in the Dark Ages, not seeing that whatever may have happened back then is, if you look at Al Gore's graph, it's a pimple compared to what is now like a growing mountain of evidence that not just, you know, climate change, you know, happening, but we have more carbon dioxide, you know, in the atmosphere than we've ever had. And there's no mystery where it's coming from. It's coming from us. It's coming from our coal-fired power plants. It's coming from our darn SUVs. So the fact that they're still saying it's not real, that we're not causing it, is just insane. So the Union of Concerned Scientists and any other, you know, credible scientific organization out there will tell you, no, this is absolutely real. It's documentable. But, of course, Myronie Bell says, well, that graph has been questioned. I said, that graph? Gore gave a 45-minute PowerPoint presentation with some 30 graphs. You know, they're just, they're thinking we're so stupid that we're going to not believe this stuff.
You know, they don't care about people. And literally all they care about is global business. And I don't know what the hell their vision of the future is. We've got a guy on the phone here, Betsy Rosenberg, host of EcoTalk, who listened to your show on Sunday. Ernest listening to LIB in New Jersey. What's up, Ernest?
Hi. I really love your show. You got me convinced that WLIB in New York, Air America Radio, is doing a tremendous job. That guy was a typical Republican deny speech. I couldn't believe that he was trying to simple-mindedly attack the issues as complex as global warming.
Okay, thanks. He's talking about Myronie Bell. That Betsy Rosenberg was talking on EcoTalk. Thanks for your call, Ernest. People are listening, Betsy. It's great.
It is. You know, I want to tell you some good news. They're going to be making, get this, a feature-length documentary film called Fog of War Meets Bowling for Columbine. It won't be called it, but that's what it's going to be. It's going to be Al Gore's PowerPoint presentation put to a Hollywood documentary. So people who saw, I'm quite serious, actually, people who saw him.
Did they shoot it at the conference?
Yes, they're going to take what happened there.
Oh, great.
Lori David, you know, who's Larry David's wife and producer, eco-activist, she felt, like we all did, that this has got to be taken on the road. So she's got the connections, and, you know, they're going to raise money. I think they already have raised enough, and get some Hollywood producers to put this, you know, out there, and hopefully it will be as popular as, you know, Michael Moore, because, you know, as you said, this is the one. There's a great quote from Janella Meadows, very quickly, the former professor. She was just a fabulous environmental activist and inspiration. And she says, you know, there's all these issues that are treated as, you know, players on the soccer field. The environment is not just another player. It is the field that holds all of it up.
That's a good one.
And makes life possible, whether or not the media spotlight is shining on it. And our big problem, and God bless Air America for, you know, putting on an environmental show, and God bless you for talking about it, you know, is that it's just not seen as an issue. Any list of, you know, issues that were, you know, talked about in the presidential campaign, or even on, you know, Yahoo's list of topics that you can go to, the environment almost doesn't even rank up there.
People just assume if they can.
Popularity ratings. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about how people feel about all his, you know, topics.
Sure.
Jobs, it's education. They don't even mention how he's doing on the environment. And guess what? That's his Achilles heel. That's where he is weakest, and it's not been exploited. And it's mind-blowing for those of us who sort of live in this world. And you know what? We're not just tree huggers. It's for all of us. It's
absolutely.
Your kids and your grandkids.
Mm-hmm. Thank God for hitting it, that Achilles heel for us, Betsy Rosenberg, the host of EcoTalk, which is on Air America from 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. every Sunday, www.ecotalkblog.com. Betsy, what do you got planned for this Sunday show, quickly?
I'm going to be doing shows all month, Mark, that came out of World Environment Day. We've got people talking about clean car technology. Are we there yet? Cars of the future.
Great.
Technology, hype or reality? We've got Teddy Roosevelt IV coming up. He was the one who introduced Al Gore. He's a Republican, a successful businessman, and he is mad as hell at the Bush administration. He said if his great-grandfather, T.R., was alive, he would give him a few words.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Betsy. You want to say goodbye, Jim?
Yes, goodbye. Thank you. Dan Bashman for you.
It was great talking to you, Betsy. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, guys.
You take care. That was Betsy Rosenberg, host of EcoTalk on Air America, 7 to 8 a.m. on Sundays. Jim, so you feel better? We covered it a bit today. It's important. She made me feel like I'm not doing enough.
Oh, yeah. You know, this whole economy, this phantom economy that we have right now is based on environmental rape.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the most part.
And this is an administration that doesn't care about individuals, only cares about corporate interests, and whatever those corporations do, no matter how much they pollute, is okay with them because it's all about money.
We need to put the environment in a lockbox.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Jim. We'll be back with
I was trying to be. What? A little humor here.
No, I thought it was great. It was hilarious. Let's go get Mort Mortensen and do the morning remembrance coming up next. 46 past the hour. Mark Maron. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Past the hour, Mark Maron here. Mark Riley is on vacation. You're listening to Morning Sedition. That's with an S on Air America Radio. Yeah. Oh, that was Riley. Hey, who's that? Who's that? What is that song? That's kind of rocks at the beginning there.
That's the White Stripes, Blue Orchid.
Is that the new one?
Yes.
Oh, boy, that's different. That kind of rocks. Man. Wow. I got to buy it now.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
There's that drum out in front. It's a little different for them, I think. Sounds a little different. You know, the problem is like, as much as they rock, and I like a couple of their other records, I don't listen to them that much.
Yeah, I know.
There's no time. You know what I mean? You keep buying CDs, there's just no time.
Yeah, that's how I feel.
It is, right?
Yeah.
So now I'm supposed to get this iPod, and there's no time. There's no time to listen to everything more than once to fall in love with it.
You're right. Especially with the iPod. I feel like I bought so many CDs, I didn't even listen to them.
I know. And it doesn't end.
It's like the new Weezer CD. I listened to it maybe four times. After that, gone.
Really? I listened to the one that you gave me once.
Wow.
And it's gone. And it's gone from recollection, too. Not a fan. Anyways, unfortunately, I got to get that, though. Because, you know, now you just, you know what you did? Just planted the seed of consumerism in me. It's like, well, that rocks. That made my endorphin spin a little bit. That got me a little buzz. So I'm going to go out and see if I can repeat that. Are there other songs in the album that buzz like that?
Yes.
Oh, dude, how many more?
Maybe three.
Oh, boy.
Four.
Wow, so I could get a pretty good buzz on for the first time I listened to it. Maybe play a little air guitar and go, wow, this is killer. And then that'll be it. Just
yeah.
I'll have it disappear into my stack with the rest of them. Unfortunately, folks, it's that time of week again when we here at Morning's Edition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of the grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh.
You all right?
Yeah, I'm all right.
Okay.
Good morning.
Okay.
Josephine Clay Ford, the only granddaughter of automotive pioneer Henry Ford, finally ran out of gas last week. A company representative said, quote, "This is one Ford that you won't see in your future." Doctors say the old Ford had valve problems.
Oh, no.
A bent frame and had to be cranked hard on cold mornings.
That's horrible.
Yes. Friends recalled during her youth, even on the hottest days, they couldn't get her to take her top down.
Oh, no.
Even though she had a great set of headlights. Oh, you vacuum in the carpet here recently?
Yeah, there's a little dust in the air.
There's a lot of dust.
You have a Kleenex, man.
You have allergies.
I know.
Oh, yeah, that's Peter.
All right. Okay, buddy.
Auto experts say Josephine was a major force behind production of the Ford Pinto.
Oh, no.
Many assume it was due to her loyalty to family business, while others in the know insisted it was just because she knew so much about explosive rear enders.
Oh, yeah.
Explosive rear enders.
Yeah, I know, buddy. It's rough.
Yeah.
Rough. So rough.
In 1940, a little bit of history for you.
Yeah, thanks.
In 1943, Josephine Clay Ford married Walter Ford II, no relation to her family, making her Josephine Clay Ford.
Okay.
Ford. Historians speculate that had he died and she married director John Ford, and after he died, married actor Harrison Ford, the resulting name wouldn't be as funny as Ella Fitzgerald marrying Darth Vader.
Elevator?
Elevator.
Oh, that's good stuff. I think you're stretching a little here. It must be because you're so sad.
Yeah. Family members requested her remains be sold for parts. Really should be a HEPA filter in this room.
Those would be classic parts.
Let me get on with this.
Okay.
Leslie Smith, creator of Matchbox cars.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Smith, beloved creator of Matchbox toy cars, was taken away last week in the world's tiniest hearse. After starting Matchbox Toys in 1952, Smith's first big success happened a year later when Queen Elizabeth II took the throne. Smith released a miniature version of her coronation coach, and soon more than a million were sold, along with miniature horses in the front and the inside.
Yeah, so, not a
very pretty family.
Yeah, I get it. You all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
In 63, Smith introduced the JFK presidential limo, replete with removable bubble top and fleeing first lady. The model failed so badly, it did even worse than the follow-up 1964 Chevy Corvair with working heater.
You all right?
Yeah, all right. You have any cocaine residue in the shoe?
No. Not for me.
Yeah,
no.
You know how I get teary-eyed.
Maybe something from the 70s might still be clinging to the asbestos tiles.
Whenever I'm on the monster, it just makes my nose run.
Get on with it.
Beloved by children, Smith's tiny matchbox cars are still prized by many adults, including Tom Cruise, who still drives one to work.
Yeah, because he's little.
He's a very tiny,
yeah.
Tiny Scientologist man. Smith requested his body be unceremoniously crammed into a coffin 1/64th the size of a real one.
Oh, man. They can do that with science now.
Anyway.
All right.
This has been this week's Morning Remembrance, brought to you by the new Andrew Ant Block. We kill bugs. This is Morris the same. Who's chopping onions?
Oh, God. John, hold it together. Are you really being sponsored by Andrew Amplock now?
Get into the block. Andrew, you're a block.
Come
AutoZone.
Yeah, AutoZone. Yeah, so yeah, it's like a theme, man. You had a couple of stories relating to automobiles.
Yes.
Then you did your little AutoZone thing.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're going to get in your car and drive away crying.
Right, Mike.
Tremendous. We're going to come back. Gerald Nadler, congressman from New York, is going to tell us about what exactly happened last Friday during a House Judiciary meeting when James Sensenbrenner, the Republican from Wisconsin, stormed out like a child, and Gerald Nadler had to, you know, be a professional and carry on business. Six past the hour. Good morning. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I am Mark Maron, Mark Riley, on vacation.
Yeah.
But not in spirit, apparently. The ghost in the machine of Mark Riley by voice. Thank you, Kalo. I appreciate that. We have been talking all morning about the House Judiciary Committee's 11th hearing on the USA Patriot Act. So it was the first hearing since April. The Democrats requested it, claiming the previous 10 hearings were biased toward the Bush administration's position of renewing the Patriot Act. Amnesty International's Chip Pitts testified and called Gitmo, quote, the gulag of our time, unquote. Representative Mike Pence, a Republican from Indiana, called Pitts' testimony, quote, anti-historical, irresponsible, and the type of rhetoric that endangers American lives, end quote. Chairman James Sensenbrenner refused to allow Pitts to respond and stormed out of the hearing like a baby, took his gavel and left the room like a child, leaving Representative Jerry Nadler objecting with a point of decency and to try and carry on with some semblance of professionalism. On the phone now is New York Congressman Gerald Nadler. So good morning, Congressman. Nice of you to spend some time with us. What were you trying to say when they cut off your mic?
Well, I wanted to say, I mean, the chairman had said that it was two things, really. Number one of the Republicans had a tirade in which he had said that the United States had always been a beacon of liberty and freedom, and that those people who questioned, who made allegations of torture and so forth and so on, were traducing our tradition of liberty and freedom and were slandering the United States and were, in fact, hurting American troops.
Mm.
Secondly, the chairman had then tried to close the hearing by saying that most of what we had been talking about at the hearing was irrelevant to the subject of the hearing, that it wasn't really the Patriot Act, that enemy combatants had nothing to do with the Patriot Act, and that Guantanamo had nothing to do with the Patriot Act. And I wanted to say, first of all, that the reason that it was true. Some of what he said was true, that enemy combatants was not a question of the Patriot Act, and that Guantanamo had nothing to do with the Patriot
Act.
But that the Republicans had refused to allow us to hold hearings or to talk about those subjects in other hearings, and that's why these subjects kept coming up in this hearing.
But detaining American citizens has everything to do with it. Yeah.
What?
Detaining American citizens has everything to do with the Patriot Act.
Yeah, but he didn't say that, didn't he?
Right.
Said that Guantanamo, we had talked also about that, but also about Guantanamo Bay. Mm-hmm. And
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And he said that they said nothing to do with it, and I wanted to say, yeah, you're right. There is some confusion. And he said that a lot of the opposition to the Patriot Act is really opposition to other policies.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yes, a lot of the opposition really is, because there's valid opposition to the Patriot Act. There's also valid opposition to these other policies, but you haven't permitted us to talk about these other policies. So they're all going to come in this morning. But second of all, the United States indeed has a glorious tradition of liberty and freedom, and it's our job to maintain that, and it's the people who indulge in torture and in detention of so-called enemy combatants without any due process or without any finding of guilt or anything, without any opportunity to be heard, that those are against American traditions, those are against liberty and freedom, and that when agents of the executive branch crush civil liberties, that is against our tradition, and those of us who question the actions of the executive branch are upholding American honor and American liberty and not defaming it. That's the statement I wanted to make, but you didn't want to let me make.
Well, yeah, because he was actually being standing in the way of liberty by storming out and ending the meeting like a child. I mean, that's unprecedented, isn't it?
Well, he has done similar things before, but in particular, this was unprecedented. The tension had been building up during the morning because he had been cutting off every witness in mid-sentence. A member gets 5 minutes to question witnesses, and when the 5 minutes expired, instead of letting them finish the thought or the answer or even the sentence, he'd cut them off in mid-sentence, which normally is not his practice. But he was very peeved because we had insisted on our right to call a minority hearing, which hadn't been done in a long time, and he was peeved that had happened at all. So he was cutting people off in mid-sentence and being extremely rude to them.
Yeah. We're talking to Congressman Gerald Nadler, New York's 8th District Congressman. I watched the footage. It was incredible how rude he was. And also, it seems to me that, you know, these guys feel empowered because of the Senate Intelligence Committee's desire to put this thing through, the Patriot Act, and to add revisions, and the president's desire to expand its power. So they feel like they can behave this way.
Well, they feel like they can behave this way because they've gotten away with it, and because, with few exceptions, the press hasn't really reported it or called them on it. There was an example a few weeks ago, which was incredibly unprecedented and incredibly against the rules and against decency, where the official committee report on an abortion bill reported a number of amendments that I and other Democrats had introduced and completely mischaracterized them. The bill provided, for example, that it would be a crime to, quote, transport a minor across state lines
to
get an abortion if there was a parental consent or notification requirement in the state she left and she hadn't gotten it.
Right.
All right, so I introduced an amendment that said, all right, but it wouldn't be a crime if the person who transported the minor was the brother or sister or grandparent.
Right.
And Bobby Scott introduced an amendment that said, well, and not if it's a taxi driver or a bus driver. What do you want from them?
Right.
And the official committee report reported that these amendments were, quote, Mr. Nadler offered an amendment to exempt sexual predators from the provisions of the act if they are siblings or grandparents.
What is that?
Had nothing to do with it. Nobody mentioned the word sexual predators.
Yeah.
In debate, in pro or con.
Right.
This was just an attempt to slander me and to slander Bobby Scott. Because
unbelievable.
His amendment was reported as he offered an amendment to exempt sexual predators from the provisions of the act if they were bus drivers or taxi drivers. And when we called them on it and said, correct the committee report, they refused.
Right.
And they said, well, what if the grandparent were a sexual predator? Can you guarantee he isn't?
Right. Yes.
And this is completely dishonest. And they maintained this through a debate on the rules and through John Conyers introduced a privilege resolution, which they voted to table by a party-line vote. And it was only when we had a second privilege resolution and when we let the word out that if we couldn't trust the integrity of House documents, we would have to stop consenting to waiving the reading of the journal of yesterday's debates.
Right.
And waiving the reading of every bill and every amendment on the floor and in committee, which would bring the House to a total standstill.
So now
they agreed to correct the record.
So now it's amazing how devious they are on all levels. And getting back to the hearing on Friday, you know, I mean, James Sensenbrenner kept trying to make to accuse the Democrats of using the Patriot Act as some sort of buzzword. And where in fact, there are many Republicans against reinstating some of the provisions and against expanding the Patriot Act.
That's exactly right. In fact, I am one of four co-chairpersons of the Patriot Act Reform Caucus. There are two liberal, if you will, co-chairpersons, myself and Bernie Sanders of Vermont, and the two conservative Republicans, Jeff Flake of Arizona and Ron Paul of Texas. And cooperating with us is Butch Otter, the very conservative Republican, who are co-chair people of the Patriot Act Reform Caucus.
Well, that's good that at least they're coming forward. Some Republicans are coming forward to fight with you on that one.
Some have.
Now, let me ask you another thing about I want to say that thank you for speaking up, because I watched your footage of that, Congressman, and I thought you were very noble and very professional, and you enabled the people to speak, and that was great. I also want to ask you about all the flack that some Democrats, like Joe Biden and John Edwards, are giving to Howard Dean. I think this is crazy behavior, isn't it?
Well, I think it's mistaken behavior. I don't know if I'd call it crazy, but I think it's a mistake. I think that, first of all, what the Democratic National Chairman is basically in charge of is organization. I mean, and Howard Dean, I think, is making a real attempt and a very important attempt to set up, to make sure that we have strong precinct-level organizations in all these so-called red states so that the Democratic candidates have a chance in those states, and Democratic presidential candidates and Senate and House candidates can wage effective campaigns. And this is the most and that's his job, plus raising the funding and so forth. And he's doing that very well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's made some statements that some people disagree with. Okay. But remember, every time, and the Republicans, of course, want to concentrate on that, and that's their right, but every time a Democrat criticizes him for a statement, it's just more attention to that instead of press attention to something we want the press to pay attention to, like the Republicans' attacks on civil liberties and their attacks on Social Security and Medicare and so forth.
Absolutely. How hard is it to say, hey, that's Howard, that's all? You know what I mean? That's
Howard. You don't have to say anything. You say, listen, the Democratic National Chairman is entitled to his opinion, period.
Exactly. Thank you so much, Congressman Gerald Nadler. We're really excited about what you did on Friday.
You
made us proud. You take care. Have a good day.
Take care.
Okay, that was great. It's great to talk to him. We're going to get into a little bit more of that Howard Dean story, and maybe a little bit more of James Sensenbrenner being a baby. If you're just tuning in, so stay with us. It's 16 past the hour here on Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
The hour, Mark Maron here. It's Air America's Morning Sedition program. Mark Riley on vacation down there with the mouse and his family. We've been talking a lot about the behavior of Representative James Sensenbrenner, the Republican from Wisconsin, storming out of a House Judiciary Committee meeting like a child with the gavel. stopping business. We spoke to Gerald Nadler, and we've been talking about this all day, that he didn't want to hear what Democrats had to say, did not want to hear any sort of dissent or opposing viewpoints, let them speak their minds. So he stormed out like a child and shut the mics off. We've got Chris calling from Sacramento to comment on that behavior. How are you, Chris?
Pretty good. How you doing, Mark?
I'm all right, man. So you saw that, huh?
Oh, I saw it a few times because the issues that they talked about were so important. You almost had to see it a couple of times.
Oh, absolutely.
Is Jim Earle still there?
Jim Earle is in the building. I'm sure he's listening.
Does he have medical benefits now?
Yeah. You're watching a documentary. Yes, yeah. Everybody's good. The thievery is over.
Oh, good. So he had a smile on his face when he walked out of the room.
Oh, God. You know, I'm going to have to watch it again now just to get a hate buzz.
Oh, yeah. I wrote him an email because he referred to what the taxpayers want, and I told him how much personal income tax I pay, and this is what I want to buy for my money. I want you to sit there and be quiet. I really wanted to say shut up.
Yes.
And be respectful, but you know, when you say be respectful, you can't tell them to shut up. and listen to what people have to say. You know, the issues, even though Gerald Nadler said that, you know, some of those things may not have been directly related. If you listen to the testimony of Carlina Tapia Ruano, she talked about how within the Patriot Act they can hold someone for 7 days. However, there is some other edict or some other administrative or whatever that they can hold someone indefinitely.
Yes, absolutely, and they can.
He asked.
They are.
He asked Deborah Pearlstein, well, who gives, you know, the president or Rumsfeld that authority? And she said, there is no authority to do that. So some of the issues were intertwining with the Patriot Act.
Oh, yeah.
So very important to bring
Absolutely.
Out.
Yep.
And the other point I wanted to make is Dan Lundgren was an embarrassment to California, and I wrote him an email and told him so. I mean, he said, you know, that there's abuses going on in Guantanamo Bay is just absurd. He was an embarrassment. He does not represent me.
Oh, good. Good for you for taking action.
All righty.
Thank you so much for calling, Chris. That's exactly how I feel in terms of, like, these guys are stifling. The Republicans will stifle any sort of, you know, constructive comments, you know, from the Democrats. This was a hearing they agreed to. The Democrats called the hearing, and they wanted to talk. There is a direct connection between, you know, detention, Guantanamo, and elements of the Patriot Act. I mean, there is a direct connection. There's no way to deny that. Right now, I'd like to set up this segment. I want to talk to Susan because she apparently watched the DNC meeting on C-SPAN, I guess, that took place in D.C. over the weekend on Saturday, and Howard Dean addressed him. You saw that?
Yeah. Hey, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm good. I have to say that, first of all, just very quickly, that I also watched the Sensenbrenner thing, and I was in despair. I actually started crying because I felt like my country was disappearing before my eyes.
Mm.
And then I watched the Dean thing on Saturday.
And you got juiced up again.
I felt great.
It was like a little televised speedball for you.
It was really good.
Yeah.
I felt really hopeful because I was telling the screener, I'm sorry, I don't know who it was, you actually said earlier that Dean had shouted one of his comments, and I actually didn't think he did. I thought that he was just speaking very
passionately.
And
that's funny because you're like, don't bring up Dean shouting.
No, I actually don't. I mean, I like it when he shouts.
Yeah.
What I was impressed with was that he wasn't. He was just speaking very. That he was controlling that meeting like a master. He was.
Oh yeah, definitely. Let me set up the story. Thanks for introducing it for me, Susan. Nice talking to you up there in Boston. What we're talking about here is that Dean, in reaction to some of the criticism he got, was, you know, out. He was at a meeting of 40 Democratic National Committee leaders. They met on Saturday in a hotel in D.C. and urged him to keep fighting despite whatever happened with the Republicans. And he told them, quote, "We are not going to lie down in front of the Republican machine anymore." That's what Dr. Howard Dean shouted. Dean also declared he'd been marketing the party beautifully. He pulled in $100,000 in unsolicited donations from the web in one day. He's definitely doing his job. He's visiting 22 states he already visited to reach out on a grassroots level to local Democrat organizations. Apparently, early in the last cycle in 2001, the Republican National Committee outraised the Democratic National Committee by a 3-1 margin. So far this year, that ratio has been cut to 2-1. And the way it was raised is very important because before they used to rely rely, the party, Democrats used to rely on soft money from millionaires, but they can't do that anymore. So officials estimate that $12 million of the $14 million the Dean regime has collected so far this year has come from people that have given less than $250. And that's pretty profound. That's regular people. Dean, Howard Dean is reaching out to Democrats who feel frustrated, who feel angry, who want to be part of their party. He's going state to state. He's doing it through the internet, you know, fundraising. And he knows in the back of his head that he doesn't have to placate any of those hoard out, you know, big money Democrats that are criticizing him, nor does he have to placate the big money money people, because they're going to be there. They're not going anywhere. He's doing the right thing. He's standing up for people, which is great. When we come back, you know, we're talking about how politicians behave. Maybe we can talk a little bit about how movie moguls behave. You know, our guest has written a book, author Rachel Pine, about Miramax in a fictional way, but hopefully she'll talk about the nonfiction as well. Coming up next here on Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, Mark Maron here at Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Mark Riley is on vacation, but that's not...
What?
There he is in my head. Ghost in the Machine. Riley Noyes from Kalo on the board. Our guest, who is in studio, let me ask you a couple questions to the audience here. You ever wonder what it might be like to work at Miramax? If so, you got to read this book. It's Rachel Pine's The Twins of Tribeca. She's been called in Time Magazine, this month's Time Magazine. It's one of five of the fantastic first novels. She worked at Miramax for a publicist for 3 years in the 90s. And a lot of the characters, as we were just talking off break, are thinly veiled people we might all recognize. Rachel Pine, the author of The Twins of Tribeca. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Don't be afraid of radio. I know you said you were coming here that you haven't done a lot of radio yet. It's going to be just talk. So let's talk about this book. So you worked at Miramax in the 90s, like in their heyday.
Right. I was there from about 1995, 1998, and mm-hmm. I basically usually say it's from Il Pacino to Shakespeare in Love.
Oh, so big movies. That was right there. Mm-hmm. That would include the English Patient, yeah?
Absolutely. It was a very exciting time in the history of Miramax because it was kind of a heyday. And I think when I started, the company had about 75 full-time employees, and it had three or four times that number by the time I left.
Uh-huh. So the characters in the book are this is based on your experience at Miramax. Well, the entire book is, really.
I mean, it's based on it, but it is truly a work of fiction.
Okay. All right. So what are the characters who represent the Weinstein brothers called?
They would be Phil and Tony Waxman.
Okay. And now,
they're twins, which the Weinstein brothers are not.
Okay. So that's a little different. That's a little fictionalizing of the Weinstein. Now, what are some of the characteristics of the actual Weinstein brothers that you added in to the characters of this book? Like, there's been talk about, like, they didn't put soap in the bathrooms. There was, you know, this kind of, like, gossip that we hear. How much of that is in the book?
There's plenty of sort of that kind of gossip, and
yeah.
My friends who formerly worked at Miramax with me said, you know, wow, I remember that.
Like what? What's a couple of those?
Well, it wasn't that we didn't have soap in the bathroom mm-hmm. enough, and it was more that we either had soap or toilet paper, but we never seemed to have them both at the same time, so it was always like, what is...
what was it? Why did they do that? You know, was it just because they didn't think to, or they were cheap, or what?
I'm not really sure, but
just weird.
But in the book, I mentioned that when
yeah.
some celebrities were around, there'd be all this really fancy, like $20 soap that showed
yeah.
up in the bathroom, and then they'd take it away after they left, so we'd all go wash our hands.
did anyone go take the fancy soap and stash it for later? Of course.
You really couldn't. Somebody was there'd be a, you know, basically an email.
Oh, really?
The soap.
They would threaten people. Look, Robert De Niro's going to be here tomorrow. Don't even think about taking any soap out of the bathroom. So how many characters now, we were talking a little bit on the break about the thinly veiled characters. Now, how many characters are in the book total?
There are 85.
That's a lot of characters to juggle in a novel. And I'm imagining some of them are making them cameo appearances that just come in and out.
Right. There are a lot of people I kind of look at as a runway show. They sort of come in,
mm-hmm.
they do their thing, they spin around, and they leave.
Yeah. Like, who are some of the characters that, why don't we just go, let's get right into it. In the book, tell me the names of the fictional character and who they represent in real life. Come on.
I mean, this is a work of fiction.
I know.
So I would say basically there are people, you know, once I knew that Miramax was going to be the publisher for this book.
Whoa. How did that happen?
That was a whole crazy story. It was great, actually. It was, you know, I had this three-chapter and outline proposal that my agent was shopping.
Mm-hmm.
We sent it everywhere except Miramax and Hyperion.
Okay.
Which is the Disney publishing arm, thinking it would be wise not to send it there.
Because they might be offended.
Exactly, okay. Or it might be stopped.
Right. They could buy the book to stop it.
Right, or okay. They could just say that anyone who buys it is going to be sued and stopped and whatever.
Uh-huh.
That was our thinking back then.
Uh-huh.
And then, so several publishers were interested, and the auction was beginning, and as far as I knew, no electronic copies of this existed, because I told my agent, look, you know, my Miramax training is... there's no electronic copy.
Right. So you're actually using it against the possibility of them taking your book.
So yeah. just because, you know, once things are on email, they're everywhere.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And then the morning of the auction, she got a call that said, you know, Miramax wants to buy this book.
Uh-huh.
And then Harvey Weinstein called me himself.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
And he said, and it was this really nice phone call. He called up. He said, I'm in Rome with Russell Crowe. And I sort of, like, checked out of the conversation for a second.
Yeah.
And then I got, you know, kind of collected myself, got back into it, and he said, you know, I really like your book, and we want to buy it because we think it'll be an awful lot of fun.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things I want to say about the lead character, the chubby twin. I'd like you to, did he say anything like that?
Sorry, no, he didn't. No. I don't think that Harvey looks in the mirror and sees Brad Pitt, but, you know, and I think he knows exactly what he's good at.
Okay.
So I think he's very, very comfortable in his skin.
So initially you get this call from Harvey Weinstein, who's your old boss, so you freak out at first. You're like, oh, my God. And then it turns out he wants to buy the book. Now, after he said that, did you get into that mode where you're like, oh, no, they just want to own it so they won't release it?
It was something that I spoke about with my agent and my attorney, and they assured me that what could happen is that if Miramax did wind up winning the auction and purchasing the book, there could be enough things built into the contract that would either force them to publish it or
mm-hmm.
revert the rights to me.
Uh-huh.
So that it, one way or another, it would get out.
Right. Oh, good. Well, so you weren't that afraid. No.
A little bit.
So when you worked over there, what exactly was your position?
I started out as the assistant to the head of publicity
mm-hmm.
and moved up a bit, and by the time I left, I was a marketing manager.
So you had to deal, I guess at times in publicity, you had to deal specifically with big celebrities that we would all know. And I'm not asking you to dish too much, but a little bit, in terms of, like, what were some of the high maintenance, or, like, what was, like, one of the things that you had to do as a publicist that just made you go, you got to be kidding?
Well, if you read about it in the book,
okay.
There are some things where... What I think is that most of the celebrities are not really personally that difficult.
Okay.
I think what you have are an awful lot of layers.
Mm-hmm.
So you have these people who, you know, you have celebrity, and then they have, you know, an assistant and an agent and a publicist and a manager. And everybody's kind of adding on to what they want. And then they get there, and they're kind of like, I didn't need all this. I needed a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
And to Evian water.
Right. Why'd they make you do this? And I guess, why do you think that is? Because you had, in other words, a lot of times you didn't think that certain celebrities were difficult, but you knew that their people were difficult in any layer of that person. Any one of those people could be a pain.
I think they do it because I think that there's a tremendous amount of pressure on everyone sort of in this industry to keep their clients,
mm-hmm.
keep their clients happy.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like,
yeah.
So this whole sort of thing goes on where everybody adds something.
Sure. Now, let's just ask, in the book, there is an episode where somebody needs to fly airline tickets somewhere.
Right. Actually, in the book, there's actually a celebrity who's nominated for an Oscar, and he's filming in New Zealand, way out in the bush. And he says he won't go unless he can fly privately.
Okay.
But he needs to fly first from New Zealand to Sydney.
Yeah.
And he needs to fly first from New Zealand to Sydney.
Okay.
And he doesn't believe in the internet, won't have any ticket, and refuses to go to the airline counter and pick up his ticket. So the character, Karen, who's kind of our heroine and narrator of this whole story,
mm-hmm.
has to find a Maori tribesman who's going to, you know,
take the tickets.
Who's going to, you know, drive a Jeep and then walk the last 20 kilometers.
Right.
To deliver the ticket. And when he gets there, the guy is so grateful. He's having a massage. He makes this guy wait outside.
He's having a massage in the middle of his, oh my, he makes the native guy wait outside with the ticket.
Right. Until he's finished. And then, you know.
So now that's not based on a series of stories, a compilation of characters.
I would say that was something that was partially true, and then I really embellished it, which is what you'll find throughout the book.
Partially true about who? Come on! You gotta give us a taste, a little bit.
Partially true about an actor who was once nominated for Best Actor, but didn't win.
Okay, all right. Has never won since?
Ben Affleck?
Okay. Is it a guessing game?
Matt Damon?
No, I'm not going to tell you.
Okay. Well, how about this? We know. You knew this was going to happen. It's going to happen anywhere you
yes,
go.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you worked at Miramax. So there's a character in the book, Eddie De Silva. All right? Now, there's been speculation that this is based on Robert De Niro. Now, you were there when De Niro was, you know, I guess, were they starting to do that partnership idea? Weren't they going to get into business together, the Weinsteins and De Niro?
You know, I don't know how much work they did or didn't do together, but their offices are all in the same building. So whether you're working with Robert De Niro a lot or not, when you worked at Miramax,
you saw him around
because he was just, you know, you were on the fourth floor and he was on the eighth floor.
Is he peculiar? Is he odd? Give me something. I love De Niro, and I want to know, is there one thing that I should know about him that I don't know already?
You know, I don't know what you know about him.
Nothing. Not much.
But he's intensely, intensely private. And I think what's happened to him is because he's around Tribeca a lot, people have felt that he's okay. It's okay to sort of run up to him with a script or you know, Robert, I want you to be in my next movie.
How annoying would that be?
So, exactly. I mean, it's tough for him.
Yeah. So did you ever go to the Oscars when you were at Miramax?
I did.
And how was that experience? I mean, I can't, it looks so bizarre to me. I can barely watch him. Did you fall asleep? I mean, it's like hours.
No, I couldn't fall asleep because I was working, and I think I wouldn't have been working anymore had I fallen asleep.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot. The book starts out at the Oscars, actually, and it's really, I think, a fun chapter.
Okay.
Where Karen's been given this job, which is to greet the celebrities and excite the paparazzi who are down the red carpet.
Did you actually do that?
I did that.
How hard is it to excite paparazzi with a real celebrity? You must be chomping at the bit already. What do you have to do?
They are and they aren't. The thing to do is it's really all about timing because it's terrible. Let's say that, you know, you come in after, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Okay. So is she in the book?
She's not in the book, but there's a character who might kind of seem a little bit like Gwyneth.
And what's her name?
Her name is Juliet Bartlett.
Okay, so that's that's okay. We know now it's Gwyneth Paltrow. Okay.
So, well, I would like to point out, though, that I made Juliet Bartlett because I thought Gwyneth Paltrow was really beautiful and she reminded me of sort of a Bartlett pear, just sort of. And then I made her a pear before she made Apple.
Okay. Okay. All right. So you were ahead of the game on the fruit naming thing.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
So,
we're talking about the Oscars paparazzi getting them geared
up. So let's say you followed Gwyneth.
Okay.
Now, that could be like a crushing experience for you.
It'd be a disaster for me. It'd be a disaster because they would just be like, follow Gwyneth, and I would get nothing.
Right. So the job of the people, you know, the kind of job I had that night was to sort of get the timing right.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe I'd hold you at the top until all of the Gwyneth screaming subsided.
So you would enable the hurting of me.
No, I would help you.
Okay, so you're working for me now, Gwyneth.
Exactly.
So you'd make sure there's enough distance, and then you'd go out and go.
But I'd also have to help you get sort of off the carpet fast enough, because it's going to be, you know, Gwyneth, because I've got now somebody else on top.
Okay.
So it's, you know, maybe it's Gwyneth.
So it's delicate. It's timing.
Right, and you don't want to hurt anybody's feelings.
Well, good for you. I mean, because paparazzi surely would. I've been in situations like that. Like, for instance, why didn't I go to the Springer party last week? You know, because I don't want to, you know, be standing next to Springer and everyone's taking pictures of him. I've been in these situations before. So, can I call you for advice if things, you know, after
Absolutely.
The book? All right, very good. Well, the book is called The Twins of Tribeca, loosely based on Rachel Pine's experience working at Miramax. There's a ton of characters, a lot of action, a lot of inside show business stuff. You should check out the book. It was rated one of the five fantastic first novels by Time Magazine this month. It was great talking to you, Rachel. I hope that your first radio experience was exciting.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks for being here, Rachel Pine. Coming up next, we'll have some closing thoughts of today's show on James Sensenbrenner, on Howard Dean, maybe a little Guantanamo action. So stay with us. 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Oh, Franken, nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Oh, Franken,
king of the
Jews.
Air America Radio.
51 past the hour. Let's land this thing. Land it. Mark Maron here. Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Mark Riley is on vacation.
Hey!
Hey! It's a little Riley in your head down there with the Mickey Mouse and whatnot. Boy, I tell you, I got some flack. I told you that.
I tell you, Chris, I got some flack for that.
That's silly.
Free plugs for Disney World. What's the matter with you? Those guys suck. Look, what can I tell you?
I love Disney World. I love it so much. Brendan McDonald loves it.
My wife enjoys it. I tell you, I was in Disneyland. I've never been to Disney World. And oddly enough, the Small World ride is the one that I like the most.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous, right?
Yeah, that one's fun.
The reason why it's so cool, Chris, is because it was designed for the World's Fair. It's like completely thematically a little different than the rest of the rides in Disney World. And there's sort of like this kind of almost a modern arty feeling to it. It's almost a Modrian painting. And there's and some other stuff, too. There's some other stuff added in there about the angles of the outside of it, the way it looks. Like a Louise Nevelson sculpture. I'm just rambling.
No,
like, who the hell knows what I'm talking about? That's not even the same era. But it just has an art. The way it's designed is very unique, and I like it. Now I'm sorry I even started talking about it.
You know, I love the Runaway Train ride.
And, I don't go on that.
Oh, no, that's great. In fact, my mother has a story about that. Every time I have a new girlfriend, she always tells the same story about me. Like, when I was 8 years old, I was jumping up and down to go on this ride, and so she had to go because I needed an adult with me.
Yeah.
And so and she was kind of terrified. You know, I was all anxious.
Uh-huh.
And by the end of it, my mom's like, wow, that was fun, right, Chris? She looks over. I'm on the floor crying, and I'm like, please make it end. And, oh, man, she loves knowing that story.
Oh, man. I've never been a huge roller coaster fan, and it wasn't when I was a kid. Too scary. And now I go on them as an adult, though, because my wife likes to go on them. So I get, and I still have that, where it's like you see people on roller coasters and just like, woo! Putting their hands up in the air, and I'm the one going, it'll be over soon. It'll be over any second. I'm clinching. You know, just I'm excited that I'm getting through it and not surrendering to the fear, but nonetheless, not a great time.
It's hard to put your hands up.
It's not a great time. I guess in there's a couple of closing notes here for the show that I'd like to talk about. Apparently, New York might get a stadium. Michael Bloomberg announced that he's getting into business with the Mets to the tune of about $650 million to build a new stadium next to Shea Stadium out in Queens, which you're excited about.
Yes.
Being not a sports guy, I'd like to see to see a new stadium. But
it's the perfect place for the stadium.
It's where a lot of people wanted it to begin with, and whether or not they get the Olympics or not doesn't make a difference now because you said we need a new stadium.
The only
right?
reason why they didn't originally do that is because the Jets did not want to go to Queens. They wanted the West Side.
Well, thank God it's not going to be there for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
But it might be okay out there in Queens. Another thing I wanted to tighten up with here is that all you people that criticized Howard Dean last week, all you people being as if John Edwards is listening, or as if Joe Biden is listening to me right now, or as if some of those other centrocrats are listening to me, dissing Bill Richardson from the governor from New Mexico, distancing themselves from Dean as Democrats, saying that he doesn't represent the whole party. Well, look, you left our flank open for Dick Cheney to go ahead and weasel his way in there. By turning on ourselves, now we got to listen to Dick Cheney say, quote, so far I think he's probably helped us more than them, end quote. To say, quote, I've never been able to understand his appeal. Maybe his mother loved him, but I've never met anybody who does. He never won anything, as best I can tell, end quote. See, open the door for this guy, the evilest man of the neocon death cult, the most evil Dick Cheney, to start hitting us like that because, what, you can't just say, yeah, that's Howard. Let me tell you something about Howard Dean. Early in the last cycle, the last campaign cycle in 2001, the last fundraising cycle, the Republican National Committee outraised the DNC by 3-1. So far this year, that ratio has been cut to 2-1. And more importantly, all the money, almost all of it, raised in the past year, okay, relied on donations from people who gave less than $250. Not from millionaires, not from the old guard of, like, you know, big money interests who fund the Democrats. Dean knows inherently in his head that those people aren't going anywhere, but he's getting out there, traveling to 22 states, reaching out to the Democratic grassroots organizations, to DNC operatives all across the country, legislators, regular people. You believe that? That's $12 million. $12 million from people who gave less than $250. That's a guy who's showing them with it. That's how the Republicans did it. All right, here we go. That's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here you've marching orders for today. One, point out that in German, Sensenbrenner means huffy, cheating, wussy man. Two, it's hurricane season again. See if the Weather Service will name one Howard or Dean. There you go. Three, suggest the government close Guantanamo and convert it into a brew pub with regular folk music nights and maybe a comedy night.
Nice.
Oh, yeah. Four, the FBI is spying on the left wing, so from time to time during the day, drop your pants and dance around. They'll see it. Five, today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. Screw the Live Aid concerts. White musicians shouldn't be helping those who are starving. White musicians should be the ones who are starving. Wake up, sheeple. It's cultural genocide, and it started with Elvis. How do you like that?
Nice.
Tomorrow, what do we got? Robert Paxton, whose book Anatomy on Fascism is blowing my mind right now, is going to be on our show to talk about fascism in America. We got Lawton Smalls. We have the Liberal Confessional. And we got you people listening. Riley will be back Wednesday. See you tomorrow, man.
Edition. Air America.